Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 362nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta.
And on the line with us, it's been a while, but we finally have dug a tunnel all the way to New Zealand and lay the pipe so that we can get Bruce Arrell back on the podcast. And for those of you who don't remember Bruce, we've used tons of Bruce's publications. And Bruce is he's with the Department of General Practice and Primary Health Care at the University of Auckland. And if you've ever looked up information on people who have written and looked at the aspects of general practice, he's a major player in this area, and we've had him to come in and talk about areas of things like insomnia and so on. And we're going to get Bruce to talk a little bit about a brand new meta-analysis that he's just done on antidepressants for treatment of depression in primary care. So welcome, Bruce.
Welcome, yep. So I'm a family doctor in New Zealand. I did train at McMaster, did my family medicine training at McMaster, although I'm from New Zealand originally, and now I'm a professor in the Department of General Practice and Primary Health Care in Auckland. So nice to be back with you guys.
Yeah, it's always great. So why don't we just jump right into it? So we're going to do a sort of a two or three part podcast series on depression, and the first one will be we're going to talk about a systematic review of and meta-analysis of antidepressants, and then we'll start to spend a little bit more time talking about what can you do on that very first visit for a person who you suspect might be depressed. So that'll probably be part two, and we may have some other stuff, but why don't we just start off with this publication that you have, Bruce, which was just released just in the last little while.
Yeah, Journal of Primary Health Care 2016.
Yeah.
Volume 8, Issue 4, page 325. So, and that's available on the web, so it's open access.
Yeah, so why did you end up doing this firstly, and then we'll get to the results?
Well, this is about the third iteration of this. I guess when about 20 years ago in practice, I looked around our patients or my patients, and there were many of them on antidepressants, and they were still depressed. And I'd had some pretty good successes with using tricyclics, but the SSRIs didn't seem to be having the same effect. And I guess I decided then I'd be interested in answering the question, were they effective? And hence signed up to do a Cochrane review of antidepressants versus placebo, because I was interested in that question. Mm-hmm. Were they any better than placebo?
And that's where that came up. Because, Mike, we've had those questions. I mean, when I started practice, it was purely just tricyclics. And now there's just a plethora of things that affect different receptors and so on. But, you know, the question has always been, are we any further ahead?
With these new drugs?
Yeah.
If anything, there was years ago a systematic review that suggested that the TCAs may be even slightly better. But Bruce will enlighten us.
Yes. So go ahead, yep. Bruce.
Yep. So anyway, so we did the first review, and this is, I think, the third update of it. So this is the latest. It's got all the trials, although it seems like the industry and our colleagues have stopped doing randomized trials. The last one versus placebo was 2010, and the last one of drug versus drug was 2012. And I guess that's an interesting question in itself. It's as much as what's missing from the primary care literature as to what's in it. For example, mirtazapine, bupropion, duloxetine, fluvoxamine, and reboxetine. So there are no trials on those against placebo. So I get the impression the industry is perhaps moving away from primary care.
Right. I was going to say those drugs definitely have studies showing that they work or have an impact,
yeah.
But they just haven't been studied in the primary care setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the patients in this study, in our review, had to be majority of patients from primary care. So the carers could be psychiatrists or nurses or other people, but they couldn't. The patients had to come. More than half the patients had to be in a primary care setting.
Okay.
And there were 17 papers, and of that, only four were not funded by the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that's interesting in itself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's that's the issue that we see constantly with drugs in the area that have anything to do with psychiatry. Is they're largely focused, you know, on drug industry trials. But at least there are papers that we can use for this meta-analysis.
Yeah, there certainly were. In terms of the age range, there was no study with anybody over the age of 70. So the range was typically 18 to 65 or greater than 15. So there's nobody younger than 15 in the trial. So basically teenagers and adults in the non-elderly range. The size of the study was interesting. There was only, the largest study was 380, and there were eight studies less than 150 participants. So that was interesting there, and that'll come up later when I talk about the funnel plot, where we actually looked at the outcomes by the size of study.
Yeah, and just so you know, when we look at the size of the study, if you know these pale in comparison to what we see with cardiovascular trials, but the reason is because in theory these drugs should have a reasonably large enough effect that you could pick it up with 100 or 200 people. And so that's why, you know, in this area, we don't necessarily need large studies. And, you know, you should be able to show an effect with this sort of number. And that's why we're seeing so many studies that have, you know, under the 300 to 400 people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always like your comment, James, that if you can't show it with a small number, you wonder how effective the drug is, if they were slam dunk effective, then you wouldn't need a lot of people, basically.
Yeah, it's like what we've talked about with general anesthesia. It requires a sample size of one.
In a randomized trial.
Yeah, in a randomized trial, you could almost get away with one. I mean, from a statistical perspective, you actually need five. But yeah, so that's the issue with that. So that, you know, the size of these studies is more than enough to help us answer the question.
The big issue, of course, in these trials is there's a very big placebo rate, mm-hmm. from about 47% to 55%, depending on the drugs. And one of the trials in there is by Tim Blaschke, an Australian. And I actually interviewed Tim Blaschke with his son, Grant Blaschke, who's a GP academic in Melbourne. And he was stunned at the 60% placebo response when he did the trial. But the funny thing with his trial was when they finished, they told patients if they're on a drug or placebo, and a bunch of people on placebo wanted to keep getting the placebo drug because it made them feel so good.
Yeah.
No. So the company actually supplied the placebo to participants for a couple of years afterwards and then got sick of it and stopped prescribing it.
You've got to love medicine, eh? I mean, Mike, we've seen that. I mean, the typical placebo response that we see in the placebo group is, you know, it varies anywhere from 35 to 40 is typically what you see, but upwards of 60. I mean, we've seen that quite often.
So, and there's some research published in the depression area that shows that the placebo response rate the response in the placebo group declines as the severity of depression increases. Mm-hmm. So in mild to moderate, which you'd see more commonly in primary care studies, you should get a better or a higher placebo response rate.
Yeah, and we do not. I don't think we need to remind everyone that is not necessarily the placebo effect. It's a lot of that is the natural fluctuation of, in this case, depression. So that's why we always have to do placebo-controlled trials of antidepressants. So what was shown then, Bruce?
Okay, the last thing on terms of the baseline table was that most of the studies were short. There was only one trial that was 24 weeks. Most were 4, 6, or 8 weeks. So in terms of, there were 9 tricyclic studies, 7 SSRI studies, 1 with venlafaxine, and 2 with myenserin. Is myenserin still available in your neck of the woods?
You know,
I'm not sure which one that one is.
Yeah, I don't. It doesn't ring a bell, although I'm not in. You know, I don't practice in any way, shape, or form where I would know that. But yeah, so I actually don't know.
I think it's an NASSA, a bit like mirtazapine.
Okay.
So when we pulled all these studies, we found that there was a statistically significant difference for the tricyclics and for the SSRIs. Venlafaxine was effective with the numbers needed to treat of 6, but there was only one study. The amitriptyline was actually, interestingly, the best one. The NNT of that was 5 to get somebody improved. With the SSRIs, they ranged from 6 to 8.5 numbers needed to treat. So that's on a background of about a 50% placebo rate. So that's so that was a bigger effect size than I had expected.
Right. And I think, so with these sort of numbers, the way that we sort of kind of think about it is, you know, none of these were head-to-head comparisons, right? This is just sort of looking at the numbers needed to treat based on almost all placebo-controlled trials. So, you know, there's no. It's hard to say that one is necessarily better than another. But I think when you talk about the numbers needed to treat, where you're, you know, you're talking about numbers sort of in the 5 to 8 or 9 range, that basically means you're seeing about a 15 to 20% absolute benefit over and above placebo, so somewhere between 10 to 20%, but closer to 15 to 20% with these agents. I think you'd agree with that, eh, Mike?
Yeah, and it's and as much as we talked about a little bit earlier, a lot of the differences would be in the numbers needed to treat, and indirect comparisons would be based on what the baseline severity of depression was. But I'll be interested to hear. That's from what we knew previously, but I'll be interested to hear from Bruce if they looked at that and if it had an impact.
We didn't look at severity in the paper, and we actually have made a mistake in the paper. We actually said most of the people were mild to moderate. In fact, when I went through and looked at the because I've had a big think about this paper. The bigger issue is that in fact most of these studies were in the severe to very severe range, which is a group of people we don't see very often in primary care. And in fact, one of the things in primary care, if people do present in the severe range, the week afterwards, they're usually considerably better in the mild to moderate range. So my feeling is it's not a good idea to prescribe antidepressants at the first visit, that one should talk to people, reframe, show some concern, give people hope. So that's quite interesting. So my guess is the industry knew if they were going to do primary care studies, they had to pick people who had quite high Hamilton D score, which is what this is based on. So that isn't reported in the paper. But the other thing that's not reported in the paper that I've done subsequently is looked at the difference between the Hamilton D score in the placebo and the drug group at the end of the trial. And according to the NICE guidelines, there should be a 3-point difference. Would you believe for none of the SSRIs is a 3-point difference? There's only a 3-point difference with the tricyclics.
Yeah, that's not necessarily surprising.
So we're going to, my next paper is going to be that probably most antidepressants don't work in primary care, would be my next paper. So that's coming.
That'll be a very, very short paper. and it'll be very depressing. But it's probably somewhat true, because Mike, when we've looked at this stuff in either previous podcasts or in presentations we've done, sort of the numbers needed to treat that you would see from things like the SSRIs and tricyclics, if it was sort of a if they were moderate to severe, you started to see numbers of needed to treat of around 5. But in the sort of the mild to moderate, the numbers were upwards of the at least 10, if not 14. Which would imply, you know, benefits in the absolute benefits in the neighborhood of around, you know, 7 or 8%, and that so it's this does kind of fit with a pattern of things that we've been saying in the past.
Yeah, and it speaks to what Bruce was saying too, that these patients were, the reason these NNTs are so good is that they're is that they were quite depressed, and so you got a better advantage. The challenge when looking at these kind of things, because they're scales, and we don't have dichotomous outcomes like MI or stroke or death or that kind of thing, we have to pick cut points, which is, I suspect, what Bruce's NNTs are based off of. And so you'll get these NNTs that look relatively good. I think for SSRIs, it was somewhere between 6 and 8.5. But the actual differences in the scales between the antidepressants and the placebo was often quite small. And so this is a trick. And when we look at these, if you can look at the NNTs and say, look, these things work like dynamite, and you can look at the scales and say, darn, these things don't work at all. And as we know, it's somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the benefit in everything, we talked about this when we talked about agitation, the effects are on the scales, the differences from the interventions over placebo are actually quite small. So we need a balanced look at both the NNTs and the changes in scale.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So, okay. So the next bit of shocking news is that we then did a funnel plot. And I realize your listeners won't be used to looking at funnel plots, but this is a analysis you can do of size of study versus benefit. And it gives you a measure of publication bias. And on one of the papers I sent you, if you can make that available, that would be great.
Yeah, we will.
It shows the funnel plot. It was in the British Journal of General Practice paper, the funnel plot with size of study versus effectiveness. And there are four small studies showing a benefit. There are no equivalent small studies showing no benefit. So essentially, what's happened to those four trials, they would be sitting in the drug company's bottom drawer, or Mike Allen or James McCormack's bottom drawer. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for the audience to realize that if you've got a small study that doesn't show a benefit, it's very hard to get that sort of study published. A little bit easier to get a small study with a big effect size, and even easier to get a big study with a big effect size or a small effect size. But if it's not significant, you really are having trouble. And we know 50% of papers don't get published. So there's clear evidence here. Now, what we did was put the SSRIs and the TCAs together to give the numbers for this funnel plot. So that's actually I never thought to do that before. And I suddenly realized, well, there's no reason for this analysis that I can't combine the two.
No, exactly. And the funnel plot is an interesting way of looking. It doesn't guarantee that there are unpublished trials. All it is a suggestion that there should be similar ones on the other side of this funnel plot type thing. So it doesn't mean that they are necessarily hidden, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're being purposely hidden. I mean, one of the indications you brought up is the fact that they are somewhat more difficult to get published. And also, you know, this is human nature. People can't be bothered to publish some things I would say that that's even a bigger issue, is that the human laziness versus the human deception issue. In that if they didn't show an effect, you're not going to publish it. And so it's just, so in other words, what that tells us is that the benefit that we are suggesting with this meta-analysis is as good as it possibly could be. It's likely less, but we just don't know.
It's probably an overestimate.
Yeah.
So the benefit is an overestimate. So the study Mike was referring to was from Irving Kirsch, where he's interested in placebo. He's at Harvard now. And this was the 2008 paper where he got the FDA studies. So he got around publication bias. And that's when he showed that for mild to moderate depression, antidepressants probably are ineffective. They only seem to work at the more severe end, which I think raises an issue of who should teach our students and our residents about depression. Because the problem is, if you've got a psychiatrist teaching this stuff, they see people in the severe range, people who aren't getting better, and that's probably where antidepressants work. But in fact, the worldview in primary care is they seem to be way less effective. And I think it's been interesting teaching this to our medical students. They really like it. and find it very, very useful. So it does raise that question of who owns depression and who should be teaching it.
Yeah.
And because there are different contexts. If you're in a secondary care psychiatric situation, it's a different context from than primary care.
And I think, I mean, what you've just stated is probably the main reason why you've published all the stuff that you've ever published, I think, is because you've noticed, and I think it's very legitimate, is that there is a difference in primary care, and that we cannot just extrapolate stuff from, you know, from a psychiatrist perspective or a neurologist perspective. People in primary care are different, and they tend not to respond in the same way. And Mike, you've seen that over and over again.
Yeah, and it comes out in guidelines as well, right? Ownership of diseases and conditions and these kind of things is a very difficult thing. And many of our colleagues who have specialized in a certain area feel a level of ownership, especially once they've done research in that area and teach in it. They have an ownership of that. And so when you try and approach them about relinquishing control of guidelines or even advice on a certain condition, there's a reluctance to it. They think that, you know, it's because it's theirs. They've lived and breathed it, and all we do is see it in part. But it's a total different approach and type of patients we're seeing. And so I think I agree with Bruce. We need to reflect on how are these conditions appearing in primary care and how do they benefit? And it was said earlier that the benefits seen in a clinical trial are likely greater than that you'll see in clinical practice. That's true of everything.
Pretty much.
Every RCT just about is going to overestimate the benefits. When you see an RCT, that's the best it can be. Almost always, it's very likely that our numbers needed to treat are going to be worse, our harms are going to be higher, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about this in the past, where it's essential for healthcare providers who are taking care of people who are on antidepressants to realize that, you know, in the placebo group, you're looking at about 40-50% will be better at 6 or 8 weeks. If you add in a drug, it's another 10-20%. So just the nice thing about it is if you give an antidepressant, 50-60% of people who you give an antidepressant to will get better, and you'll all, you know, get together later on and shake hands and go, aren't we both wonderful? Well, and I've seen you do that in practice, Mike, just in case people
absolutely
are wondering.
Yeah.
The take home message should be for our colleagues is that, is to try talking with patients first. My mantra now is talk first, prescribe later, because I think people do get better having seen by Michael Barlant, the British psychiatrist in Britain in the 1950s, coined the term the doctor as the drug. I would say in the modern term, the clinician as the drug. The power of just talking to somebody about their life from a third-party point of view is incredibly powerful. And, you know, that's where your 50% comes from, I think, in part.
Oh, certainly, in part. And so that's why it's so important that when, you know, you see a person who responds to the drug, it's probably at least an 80% chance it had nothing to do with the drug. It had to do with exactly what you're talking about, Bruce, the interaction with the healthcare provider or sort of the natural history of the condition, regression to the mean, and all those sorts of things. And so it's so important to have those conversations. And I cannot tell you how much I agree with you is that, you know, the very first, especially mild to moderate depression, you should almost, if you ever start a drug right first off, I think you've missed the boat.
Well, and there's all sorts of risks with that patients then can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And when a patient overdoses on your medication, it's pretty sobering.
Yeah. I was going to say these drugs aren't without side effects. And I know in your paper you found, you know, a fair number of people had to withdraw from it, from these agents.
You know. And there is a big dropout rate anyway in these studies, so that's a bit of a problem.
Right.
Quite big dropout rates.
Yeah. But I know
just coming back to the review, I looked at another review of primary and secondary care, and there were, in terms of fluoxetine, there were 17 trials in secondary care and only one in primary care, which again I think shows the predominance of secondary care trials in the area. And is that relevant to primary care? I think is the big issue.
Yeah, it is an issue.
Yeah, there's no, it's very, very tricky. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay.
Bruce, I just wanted to say before you went in that the funnel plot that's in there, for those of our listeners who are geeky enough, this is probably your best funnel plot that you'll find for using as a, as an example of teaching. There's some dotted lines drawn in there to differentiate between small and large trials and small and large effects. It's really quite helpful for teaching. And, you know, what James was saying is true. We don't, all this does is suggest that there may be trials missing on the rules of probability. But, and then why that occurs, we've talked about lots about that. It's, you know, is it drug company related? Is it actually just people not publishing? And as James pointed out, there's other research showing that it's probably just people in a lot of cases not thinking that trials that show no benefit are of any interest. It's kind of like what the Tragically Hip says, no one cares about something you didn't do.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are listening and don't know who the Tragically Hip are, they are from Canada.
They're Canadian.
And, yeah. and a very, very good band if you ever get a chance to listen to them.
Anyway, so, I thought I'd put a plug in for them, and they're going to give me a record deal. So
Yeah.
No, I've heard you sing, Mike, and I'm sure they'll put you in the band somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think he'll be playing the triangle.
I was going to say the back on the triangle. Or the cowbell. I could get moved up to the cowbell.
Yeah, because you always need more cowbell.
So there were a couple of conclusions we came to with the thing. We the issue is whether there should still be drug versus placebo trials in primary care, and we suggested strongly that that be the case, because I think if you do drug ones, neither, if it was in mild to moderate depression, neither may be beneficial, but it looks like they're equivalent, and I think that can be a bit of a con.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And from an ethics perspective, there's a big debate about that. But the solution to it is very, very easy. Is as long as you explain and give the benefits and harms to the person, you know, whether or not it's you might get a placebo or you might not get a drug. As long as they're aware of the advantages and disadvantages of both of those, you can do placebo-controlled trials in depression. There is no issue associated with it from an ethics perspective, if in fact you give appropriate consent, which is always debatable. But yeah.
So our final conclusion was it was important to have drug placebo trials in primary care, as the range of depressive illnesses encountered are mainly in the mild to moderate spectrum, where antidepressants are generally less effective. Research is needed, which is free from industry funding and of sufficient power and duration to determine effectiveness over a longer time frame.
Yeah, because I think those are the key messages, that we don't actually know what happens after the 8 weeks or so. So but basically, let's just sort of wrap this up. It sounds like whether you use a tricyclic or an SSRI, you get about a 10 to 15% absolute benefit increase on top of the placebo group response. And then in looking at your withdrawal rate, you see somewhere around a 15 to 20% withdrawal rate for tricyclics for probably a variety of reasons. Some of them obviously going to be side effects, because you're going to see side effects in that with these medications.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
So anything else, Mike, you want to add?
Bruce is kind of blowing apart our traditional approach of prescribe first, talk second, listen third.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're such iconoclast, you guys.
I know. Yeah, I try not to listen to anybody on the podcast at all. So that makes it really tricky. So I think, why don't we sort of sum that up. And so, Bruce, these sorts of papers are so important, because it takes the concept of what actually happens in primary care. And that's why our podcast is basically a primary care podcast. So we typically try to sell stuff at the end, and I don't think we can sell a whole lot of stuff from the course perspective, Mike, because I know that your course is coming up in Alberta in a few weeks, where I'm going to be at, you're going to be at, Mike and all those guys are going to be there, is sold out. So the only way they could come and or see it is to do it online.
Yeah, do the webcast. The webcast is still obviously open. Mm-hmm. It is filling up as well, but there are still lots of spots there. So encourage anyone interested. There is a certain convenience to the webcast on Saturday morning when you wake up in your with your fuzzy slippers and your coffee and house coat, listening to the or watching the presentations online, but still being able to interact with the speakers. I think there's some merits to that some people have enjoyed in the past.
Yeah, and it's so useful in that when I present, I drink coffee and wear fuzzy shoes.
Mm-hmm. And we try and get you to wear the house coat, which is always a challenge.
Yeah, because it's either that or not the house coat.
Yeah, that's right.
That's and right. I'm going to come to one of your shows one day, guys. Fly all the way up to Auckland to Vancouver and come and see it.
Yeah, it's only, a 13-hour flight?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Time for a meal, a sleep, and a movie. It's nice. Great. Fantastic.
So I think, when we got our course happening in Vancouver, we've just... 99% finalized the program, so we'll be putting that out in not too distant future. It's May 4th and May 5th here in Vancouver. So I think we've sold as much as we can, so I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Bye.